a new treatment for migraine.
Curing hepatitis C in disadvantaged populations.
What does the latest data about suicide tell us?
And a less invasive way to handle swallowing disorders.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on December 6th, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to turn first to the New England Journal of Medicine. I served up a new treatment for migraine. I need to say the name of this thing before I forget how to say it. It's called Ubrogepant, like bro. And I'm just wondering who in the world comes up with these names for all of these things that are just total tongue twisters. And thank God for the internet so that I can listen to somebody else say it before I attempt to do it. It turns out that this is an oral administration, which is great. It's a small molecule calcitonin gene-related peptide receptor antagonist. Yikes! All right. What does all that mean? Well, so I learned something interesting, that this calcitonin gene-related peptide is something that's used in the trigeminal nerve, and it conveys inflammation and pain sensations and is thought to be one of the pathways that's important in the development of migraine and the number of symptoms, especially the pain that's around it. So what they did was they took 1,672 participants and they randomly assigned them into three different groups, one of whom received placebo, one 50 milligrams of this drug and the other 100 milligrams. And then they said, hey, what happened? Did you have a relief of your troubling symptoms of migraine and relief of pain? At 2 hours, 11.8, almost 12% of the folks in the placebo group did have relief from pain, and just over 19% in the 50 milligram group, and 21.2% in the 100 milligram group got relief from pain. As far as the side effects were concerned, they were most often nausea, somnolence, and dry mouth. So I think this is cautiously optimistic news about something that might be useful for the treatment of migraine.
The reason I think knowing about this and other gepants, other drugs like this, is it's a different medication in the armamentarium to treat migraine headaches. It's twice as effective as placebo in this particular study. Now, what we don't know is how it compares to the other treatments. This is a one-time administration, so does recurrent use make it either more effective or less effective or the same? But again, it's nice to identify a different pathway to have multiple different treatments available to people with migraines.
And let me just note that these gepants, this new word that I suspect we're going to be hearing more about, is the terminology that's used to describe these small molecule calcitonin gene-related peptide antagonists. So that at least is a good development instead of having to spit out that whole mouthful. Since we're in the New England Journal of Medicine, how about if we stay there, talk about this very common problem? I seem to hear an awful lot about it when I see folks in the chaplain role. This issue with swallowing, and how should we treat that?
There are a number of different things that can cause swallowing disorders. This particular one we're going to address today is called idiopathic achalasia. Idiopathic means we don't know what causes it. And achalasia is a swallowing disorder in which the esophagus has two problems. The lower muscular bundle that prevents acid from coming back into the esophagus from the stomach, called the lower esophageal sphincter, doesn't relax. Furthermore, the esophagus doesn't have normal contraction pattern, called normal peristalsis. And the major treatments related to that currently are either to put a balloon down and to dilate the sphincter, or to do surgery called a myotomy. Studies have been shown to be equally effective. Well, now there's a new therapy out. It's endoscopic myotomy. It's called POEM, peroral endoscopic myotomy. But you do it through the esophagus, a multicenter randomized trial of 221 patients, randomly assigned to either undergo routine myotomy or to undergo POEM. And they followed these individuals for 2 years. And what they determined was there was success rate in 83% of those that had the POEM and 82% success rate in those that had the routine myotomy. Serious adverse effects occurred in about 3% of those who had the POEM and about 7% of patients that had the surgery. The only downside was at 3 months and 2 years, they passed an endoscope to see whether there was any irritation, any esophagitis. And it was more common in those that had the peroral oral procedure. At 3 months, about 57% of those that had POEM had esophagitis versus 20% of those that had the surgical myotomy. And even at 2 years, esophagitis incidences were 44 and 29% respectively.
And so what are the clinical consequences of this persistent esophagitis? Are we worrying about Barrett's?
That's the key. That's what we don't know. We don't have a long enough follow-up to realize, is this esophagitis going to be a problem or not? If you're treating a less invasive procedure for Barrett's, which is a precancerous condition, then it may not be a fair trade-off.
And I would remind you that we've reported on, first, the association between Barrett's esophagus and frank esophageal CA, and then the lack of an association most recently. And so I kind of call that into question. It is certainly something I would look at a little more closely. And then tell me about balloon dilatation in these folks and how that compares.
What they said was, based upon previous studies, the balloon and surgical myotomy had essentially the same results. The one thing about balloon dilatation is it may need to be done more than one time. The surgical myotomy is usually definitive.
Yeah, well, so that's another thing that if I were following this up, I would definitely be looking at.
Fair point. I guess the most important thing, and I'm glad you brought it up, is we need to have a longer-term follow-up to see whether these procedures, which appear to be equally effective in terms of clinical success, are equally effective over the long term.
Turning to Annals of Internal Medicine, this daunting study, really, on suicide case fatality rates in the United States between 2007 and 2014. The authors admit in this manuscript that even as they crunched these numbers until 2014, there was more recent data that was available that was not included in this analysis. And the only reason I bring that up is because we're well aware that the opioid epidemic has really resulted in probably some changes to these stats. And I'm not sure that we fully appreciate what those are yet. But in any case, they took a look at suicide deaths and they defined this new term for me, the suicide case fatality rate, as the proportion of suicidal acts that are fatal. And I think we've all been struggling with this terminology around suicide, whether we call that successful suicide. And so I've felt good that there's finally a term that's more descriptive that is useful here. They took a look at the National Vital Statistics System, and they found that the number of suicide deaths that took place during this time period were 309,000 plus. They also looked at those non-fatal suicide attempts that required treatment in emergency departments or resulted in hospitalization. And again, the authors say this results in an N that's probably significantly smaller than it is in reality. And I agree with that. There's probably lots of non-fatal attempts that don't come to the attention of emergency departments or result in hospitalizations. Taking a look at these numbers a little bit more carefully, they found that 8.5% of suicidal acts were fatal. That was 14.7% for males versus 3.3% for females. Among those aged 15 to 24 years, 3.4% of suicidal acts were fatal. Among those aged 65 years or older, it was 35.4%. Drug poisoning accounted for just under 60% of the acts, but only 13.5% of the deaths. Firearms and hanging accounted for only 8.8% of the acts, but 75%+ of the deaths. And they also looked at this geographically and found out where different suicidality was taking place and the method that was utilized. So I think, of course, this is really useful because it helps to describe places where interventions might be most effective.
I agree. And Elizabeth, I'm glad you brought up the point. People would say, as you mentioned, successful suicide. There's nothing successful about suicide. We want to stop the acts. We want to stop the fatality of it as well. In 2017, there were more than 47,000 individuals in the United States alone that died by suicide. About 1 in 12 suicidal acts was fatal. If it was a firearm, 9 in 10 of those were fatal. We do need to direct our attention to try to prevent suicides.
Let us then turn to our final one, also in Annals of Internal Medicine, taking a look at hepatitis C virus screening and care.
Although you had selected this particular article, kudos to the first author, B.J. Turner, Barbara Turner, who was a colleague of mine in San Antonio, because this addresses a really important issue. identifying and treating hepatitis C in disadvantaged populations. With the advent of new drugs, we're able to cure over 90% of individuals that have hepatitis C, especially in the early phases before it becomes advanced cirrhosis or advanced liver disease. Unfortunately, you can't treat it unless you screen for it, and the disadvantaged populations are less likely to get screened. So what BJ Turner and her research group did was they used processes and outcomes that have been known to be effective in studies of insured populations. It's called the STOP-HCC, the Screen, Treat, or Prevent Hepatocellular Carcinoma. It's a multi-component intervention to screen for hepatitis C in safety net primary care practices. And so they applied this to 5 federally qualified health centers and 1 family medicine residency program at the University of Texas Health Science Center, San Antonio. And these centers, by the way, serve low-income communities. Before the program started, less than 1% of these individuals was being screened for hepatitis C. They had care coordinators that helped walk these individuals through all the steps in terms of screening, determining whether someone was actively infected or not, making sure they received the drugs, making sure they completed the treatment. So it required some care coordination as well. Ultimately, in the long term, what the health system decides is, well, this takes some manpower, it takes providing medications, it costs something, but in the end, that cost is less than treating people that have cirrhosis or advanced liver disease or the end stage hepatocellular, that is liver cancer. What BJ and her research group showed was that it can be done, and it can be done to a much higher rate than is currently being done with the right resources.
And among those who are insured, what is the current rate of Hep C screening and treatment?
Well, it's interesting. If you go to the VA system, in which they've really embraced this, at some VA centers, it's over 90%. In the general population, it's probably closer to 25 or 30%. On our electronic medical record, on many others, when someone's been the ages of 45 and 65, it pops up a reminder. Have they been screened for hepatitis C? So there are a lot of ways that we can increase the screening rate. The VA showed that we can do it. I'm not sure that in general population is done very well, and certainly in disadvantaged populations, less than 1% routinely.
So let's all get screened. On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.